And now, stay tuned for the KBOO Morning News.
Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Friday, February 17th, 2006. I'm Chris Andre.
I'm Jim Thompson.
Coming up, IBM plans to close a call center in Hillsborough. Senate panel has decided against an inquiry into Bush's domestic spying program. And Israel says it will seal the Gaza Strip after Hamas-controlled Palestinian parliament is sworn in. Portland area weather, mostly cloudy, chance of snow. Windy, especially in the Eastern Gorge, highs in the 30s tonight. Mostly cloudy, chance of snow, temperatures in the 20s. There's a freeze warning for some coastal areas and the Cascades.
IBM plans by July 2007 to close a 620-person call center in Hillsboro, which fields customer service calls for General Motors. The announcement of the closure comes when GM is scrimping on costs, although it is unclear that GM instigated the Hillsboro move. The automaker plans to cut thousands of jobs, trim employee benefits, and reorganize operations to stem losses. The news also runs counter to an otherwise growing call center sector in Oregon, which employs about two-thirds more workers than in 2001. An employee of the Hillsboro call center said an IBM subcontractor told workers that the GM work would be sent out of the country. IBM spokeswoman Jenny Galitz would not specify where the work would go. IBM, which recently won the contract to operate GM's three U.S. vehicle call centers, decided with its subcontractors that the work would be better integrated into our global network of delivery centers. IBM also plans to close a 400-person call center in Tampa, Florida, and reduce staff at a 500-person call center in Austin, Texas. All three centers handle GM's vehicle sales, servicing, marketing activity in North America.
1 year ago, Portland Mayor Tom Potter drove to Salem to demand more money for education and to launch his campaign to help Portland's public schools. But legislators ignored him. Suburban leaders rejected his call for a regional schools tax to focus on their own needs. Multnomah County leaders declined to help. Now, Portland public schools leaders have backed off Potter's proposed $79 million citywide income tax package after the idea proved unpopular. The next time out, Potter hopes to have help. Yesterday, he invited more than 100 people to the Oregon Convention Center for a morning-long education summit. The guest list included school leaders and parents, but it was also heavy on people who didn't support the mayor's proposal or aren't often involved in local funding debates, including business owners and the city, state, and federal delegations. The looming pachyderm in the room raised its sales tax head again, staring down political operatives, weighing the merits of money versus brains. This from the Oregonian.
The state has scheduled four public hearings on the proposal for Oregon vehicle emission standards to match California's by the 2009 model year. The Oregon Environmental Quality Commission adopted the rules on a temporary basis in December and proposes to make them permanent. If Oregon adopts the rules, Washington State's matching rules will become effective. The DEQ has drawn up a schedule of hearings for Medford, Bend, Pendleton, and Portland. The DEQ said in a statement that comments about the rules can be submitted by mail to its air quality division.
It's evident at first glance. The mane of brown hair flowing to his lower back from under the black beret tilted nattily on his head, that the gathering man is different. Sandy Path, director of the Lincoln City Visitors and Convention Bureau, said he's a unique individual. He is an attraction. She said, "We've had a number of tourist groups come here simply to have the experience of going to the beach with him." Lee Gray is in knee-high rubber boots and carrying what he calls the tools of my trade, a bucket and long-handled screwdriver. Lee Gray is the gathering man. It's with these implements that he extracts the majority of the food that he eats from the sands and the rocky tide pools of the Lincoln County coast. It's from these beaches and nearby forests that he gathers the bulk of his annual income. Gray makes most of his living picking mushrooms and wild greens and selling them to local restaurants, although he also runs a catering business, has written cookbooks and magazine articles, sells a range of artwork, and does an occasional gig as a musician. A marine biologist from Newport once introduced him, when he was doing fish fillet demonstrations at the governor's cook-off, as Lee Gray, the wild gourmet of Depot Bay. Gray caught frogs and sold their legs as a youngster, continually studied wild foods and how to prepare them, and put in a distinguished career as a chef in fancy restaurants in Beverly Hills. But the survival bug still nagged him. He quit everything in 1980 with the idea of finding a cave to live in, and during the winter of 1981 to 82, settled into such a cave on a bluff above the ocean just south of Cape Perpetua. This from the Salem Statesman Journal.
What a nice story. The Senate Intelligence Committee decided yesterday not to investigate President Bush's domestic surveillance program, at least for the time being. Senator Pat Roberts, Republican of Kansas and chairman of the panel, said during a closed session, quote, "I believe that such an investigation is currently unwarranted and would be detrimental to this highly classified program." While Mr. Roberts' announcement signaled that the administration's eavesdropping program would not be subject to Senate scrutiny, there was no guarantee that the House would not go ahead with an inquiry of its own. Roberts said, quote, "An agreement in principle had been reached with the administration whereby lawmakers would be given more information on the surveillance operation run by the National Security Agency." But the committee's ranking Democrat, John Rockefeller IV of West Virginia, was clearly unhappy after the meeting and said it made no sense to pursue legislation when the full details of the surveillance program were not known. Roberts said Rockefeller's proposal for an investigation would be reconsidered when the committee reconvenes on March 7th. Although Republicans outnumbered Democrats 8-7 on the committee, there had been some suspense over whether the panel would vote to investigate the operations. This from the New York Times.
Scooter Libby, former White House aide charged in the investigation of the leaking of a CIA operative's identity, is now seeking access to information that some say would threaten national security, grand jury secrecy, and presidential executive privilege. Lawyers for I. Lewis Scooter Libby, Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff, are asking a federal judge to force special counsel Patrick Fitzgerald to turn over evidence ranging from communications between reporters and their sources to highly sensitive intelligence briefings provided to President Bush. In a 32-page response to Libby's requests filed with the court late yesterday, Fitzgerald had said he has turned over more than 11,000 pages of classified and unclassified evidence to the defense, more than he is required under law. Fitzgerald said he has given defense attorneys everything. His prosecutor said he's not required to give the defense the statements and testimony of reporters who will be called as government witnesses at the trial. The prosecutor also said he gave the defense documents about reporters who obtained information about Valerie Plame from sources other than Libby. But Fitzgerald said he had withheld the specifics about the reporter's sources to protect grand jury secrecy in his ongoing investigation.
Schools are blocking huge numbers of poor children from getting free tutoring. In a Capitol meeting sponsored by House and Senate education leaders of both parties, tutoring providers pointed out to what they call an unkept federal promise. Low-income parents are supposed to get a free tutor for any child who goes to a school that gets federal poverty aid, but has not made steady progress for three straight years. Parents get to pick the tutor they want, even a private one, from a state list. But that central pledge of the 2002 No Child Left Behind law is often not being met. Only 11% of eligible children received tutoring in the 2004 school year. The numbers of underserved kids could be even higher because data collection is not always strong. The low numbers of tutored kids are not because of a lack of interest, but because some schools are making help nearly impossible for parents. The Education Industry Association, a lobbying group for more than 800 corporate and individual members who provide services, organized the meeting. The tutoring provision is a lucrative opportunity for the industry, particularly as the doors to more schools open. But the event was also sponsored by the Republican chairman and top Democrats of the House and Senate Education Committees, who have heard complaints that the law is not working.
Several environmental groups and organic farmers are concerned with genetic contamination of conventionally grown crops by biotech varieties. They sued the federal government yesterday in an attempt to reverse the approval of genetically engineered alfalfa. The lawsuit alleges the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Environmental Protection Agency didn't adequately investigate environmental effects such as cross-pollination of the biotechnology crop with conventional alfalfa. This, in turn, is used mainly to feed cows. The USDA approved the alfalfa last June after the EPA said it had no objections. Organic farmers and conventional growers are concerned that genetically engineered plants will accidentally mix with their crops and scare away customers who pay premiums for organic foods and otherwise refuse to buy biotechnology crops. The lawsuit said farmers are concerned about losing alfalfa export sales of $480 million annually in biotech-adverse countries like Japan and throughout Europe. The lawsuit asks a judge to overturn the USDA's approval and order the agency to conduct an extensive study on the consequences the biocrop will have on the environment. Some alfalfa farmers are also concerned that biotechnology behemoth Monsanto will force them to pay technology fees if the genetically engineered crops mix with their conventionally grown crops. Monsanto, which controls the biotech alfalfa patents, requires farmers to pay a premium to use its seed and sign contracts promising not to save seeds from one year to the next.
Two bills to make it easier for Louisiana's displaced persons to be able to vote passed through the state's legislature on Wednesday and are expected to be signed into law. A version of one of the bills that passed had been voted down on Monday, causing a group of black lawmakers to walk out of the special legislative session called by the Louisiana governor. Christian Roseland has more.
Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco is expected to sign into law SB 22 and HB 12, two bills that will allow voters who registered by mail to be able to vote absentee and also set up satellite voting centers in 10 parishes. Lawmakers say that the intent of these bills is to enable those displaced to vote in local elections where they lived before the storm. Both bills were proposed by New Orleans lawmakers, where as of January there are 300,000 fewer people living than last July. HB 12 had initially been defeated, triggering a walkout by the Louisiana Black Caucus, but an amended version of the bill passed on Wednesday. Governor Kathleen Blanco told local press this week that she couldn't say that the effort to keep the displaced from voting was not racially motivated. Joe Cook, executive director of ACLU Louisiana, which lobbied for both bills, explains the importance of these measures.
If you make it onerous, then you put a barrier up, and then a lot of people won't exercise their right to vote. And people have already been through too many changes. We should not disenfranchise them on top of that.
For FSRN, I'm Christian Roseland.
Native American AIM activist Leonard Peltier's attorneys are fighting for his release in Missouri's 8th District's Circuit Court of Appeals for a possible retrial, posing a legal challenge to the government's right to have prosecuted Peltier in the first place. Peltier was convicted in 1977 for the murder of two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975. Robin Carnine has more.
This year marks the 30th year that Peltier has been incarcerated within the U.S. federal penitentiary system. After spending the first of two life sentences in a Leavenworth, Kansas prison, he was moved this past summer to a Lewisburg, Pennsylvania federal prison to serve out the second life sentence. Peltier's defense attorney, Barry Bachrach, explains the injustice of Peltier's 1977 trial and why this week they have filed an appeal and have asked for a new trial.
It's our position that since the alleged crime took place on Indian country, that he should have been charged under the Indian Crimes Act, and that's the only way the federal courts have jurisdiction. He was charged, tried, and convicted under statutes which the government claims are general statutes, which we contend by their language apply only on so-called federal enclaves or federal territory.
On February 4th, 2 days prior to Peltier's historical arrest by Canadian Mounties back in 1976, over 400 people marched over 2 miles in driving rain from the Puyallup Nation to the downtown federal courthouse, according to organizer and LPDC activist Arthur Miller. Supporters for Peltier braved one of the biggest wind and rainstorms in several years to participate in the 13th annual Northwest Regional International Day of Solidarity with Leonard Peltier March and Rally for Justice in Tacoma, Washington. Last year, Robert Blue Pony was on site and acknowledged Peltier's imprisonment as a sacrifice.
I'm all for getting Peltier out. In a way, he's like a soldier. He's spending time in jail.
Many supporters carried signs with messages asking for Peltier's release and freedom, while the war in Iraq was also on many people's minds.
1, 2, 3, 4, free Peltier and stop the war! 5, 6, 7, 8, let him out those prison gates!
If Peltier is turned down again for a new trial, his chances to gain his freedom won't be until 2008, when he comes up for parole consideration. This is Robin Carnine in Washington State.
Israel said yesterday that it would begin sealing the Gaza Strip after the Hamas-controlled Palestinian parliament is sworn in this weekend. The action accelerates the Israeli campaign to weaken the Islamic militant group. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, meanwhile, will demand that Hamas publicly accept his goal of reaching a peace deal with Israel and recognize past agreements with the Jewish state. Aides to Abbas declined to say what steps he would take if Hamas rejects his demands. Hamas officials said yesterday they expect to reach a compromise with Abbas, and the group announced it would nominate Ismail Haniyeh as prime minister. He is known as a pragmatist and has served as a liaison between Hamas and the long-ruling Fatah party. Since Hamas won Palestinian legislation elections last month, Israeli leaders have taken a tough line against the group. They have rallied international opposition to Hamas and said there will be no dealings with the militants until they change their ways. Senior Israeli officials approved a series of tough measures yesterday aimed at crushing the Gaza Strip's teetering economy.
A team of legal experts organized under the United Nations has found that the U.S. is in violation of international human rights laws that they are obliged to follow at the Guantanamo Bay prison in Cuba. The U.S. says the so-called war on terror is only bound by humanitarian law and is not applicable to international human rights laws. But after meticulous examination of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and the UN Convention Against Torture, a team of legal experts say that under current international law, the prison at Guantanamo Bay is unacceptable. Manfred Nowak is the UN Special Reporter on Torture.
We arrived at the conclusion that all the detainees presently held in Guantanamo Bay are victims of arbitrary detention. That means a violation of the right to personal liberty. Therefore, there are only two solutions, either to release them or, in case you have enough evidence that those persons actually committed a crime, then they must be brought before an independent court and then having a fair trial, and then they might be sentenced to long prison terms if they have committed these crimes. The military commissions which the U.S. administration has established in Guantanamo Bay do not fulfill the minimum guarantees of independence and a fair trial as laid down in Article 14 of the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights.
The team of legal experts also looked into allegations of violations of the right to not be subject to torture, the right to health, and violations of freedom of religion. New, previously unreleased graphic and disturbing photographs appeared today on Salon.com, just one day after photographs appeared on Australia's SBS television, all depicting the apparent physical and sexual abuse of Iraqi prisoners under U.S. custody at Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. Just a few days ago, an unsettling video was released of what appears to be occupation troops severely beating young Iraqi civilian boys. UN Special Rapporteur Nowak says that his team's findings at Guantanamo, along with separate findings from Abu Ghraib, are a threat to U.S. democracy and to human rights around the world.
I would say that what has been found out in relation to Guantanamo Bay, but also Abu Ghraib and other places of detention, is very serious for a country which was famous for being one of the oldest democracies in the world and for having actually invented human rights during the American Revolution together with the French Revolution, and having been always a model for the rest of the world for its strong belief and practice of democracy and human rights. And if in the fight against terror, where we fully can understand that this is a major task, but if there now the absolute prohibition of torture, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment is put into question, if there are methods used that are opening up Pandora's box, then we are very, very quickly getting into a dangerous situation. And I think it is very important that, in my opinion, that the United States government is taking our recommendations very seriously.
But the White House has rejected the recommendation to close the prison at Guantanamo. And although the UN report recommends the facility's closure, it also urges the U.S. to try prisoners in domestic or international courts and cites that indefinite imprisonment is unlawful. White House spokesman Scott McClellan maintains that all prisoners are treated humanely by the U.S. military, yet even though the U.S. did invite the United Nations to visit the Guantanamo prison, the team was not allowed to speak with individual prisoners and question them about their treatment at the detention facility. The team rejected the U.S. offer, citing that it was extremely unlikely that any prisoner would speak of torture in front of military prison guards. Special Rapporteur Nowak says that it is in the interest of the international community for the U.S. to properly respond to the United Nations report.
That was Otto Bogado for Free Speech Radio News.
Iraq's human rights minister called on U.S.-led forces yesterday to hand over all Iraqi inmates at U.S.-run prisons to the Iraqi government, following more footage of prisoners being abused. Al-Chalabi told Reuters, quote, "We are very worried about the Iraqi detainees at Abu Ghraib. The multinational forces and the British forces should hand them over to the Iraqi government." He went on to say, quote, "This is a very dangerous issue that the Iraqi government should review. The Iraqi government should move immediately to have the prisons and the prisoners delivered to the Ministry of Justice. U.S. forces are holding about 14,000 detainees in Iraq." This from Reuters.
Colombian President Alvaro Uribe has met President Bush at the White House in Washington to discuss ongoing free trade negotiations. Trade talks between the two countries have reached a crucial stage. The right-wing Washington-sponsored Uribe is leading the Colombian team personally, but differences remain over agricultural issues. The U.S. sees trade as a way of creating new jobs to fight Colombia's drugs trade, which accounts for much of the U.S. cocaine supply. President Bush described the meeting as difficult, but said he was hopeful. Uribe said success would depend on a push from both sides. The main differences are over agricultural issues, such as trade protection. The U.S. wants greater access to Colombia's markets, such as rice and poultry, whereas Colombia wants the U.S. to make its health control for farm products less stringent. Both sides see an agreement as a means of fighting the drugs trade. Bush said he and Uribe spoke about giving people alternative means of earning a living. This according to the BBC.
People in southern Somalia are starting to die from thirst in the worst drought in over 40 years in some parts of the country, according to the BBC. People are surviving in the equivalent of 3 glasses of water a day in temperatures of over 100 degrees. Oxfam reports an almost unprecedented situation where people beg for water along the sides of the road. All surface water has gone. Boreholes are running dry, and people are walking up to 45 miles in search of water. The 830 milliliters available per person per day has to be used for drinking, cooking, and washing. Schools and local groups have collected $100,000, a large sum in an impoverished country, to pay for relief effort. Oxfam says it will launch a similar operation next week, but is predicting that without water supplies, more children will die. Relief efforts in Somalia are made difficult by a lack of proper roads and the absence of a functional central government, with control of the country divided among rival militia groups. The World Meteorological Association has warned the Horn of Africa will remain in the grip of a drought until at least April.
The Nigerian military says an army helicopter has attacked barges used in oil smuggling in the Niger Delta. The militant group, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, however, condemned the raid and accused the military of targeting civilians. The attack came as UK Foreign Secretary Jack Straw paid a visit to the oil city Port Harcourt in the Niger Delta. There's been a recent spate of violent incidents involving oil industry facilities in the Delta region. A spokesman for the military task force in the Delta said one of its helicopters attacked eight barges being used to smuggle oil after spotting them on a routine flight near the village of Okerenkoko. The Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta released a statement immediately after the raid, saying the helicopter had fired rockets and machine guns at targets on land and accused the military of targeting civilians. The Nigerian military does not normally attack barges used in smuggling. It's the first major military operation in the Delta since MEND, or MEND, carried out a string of attacks on the oil industry, including the kidnapping of four foreign oil workers who are held hostage for almost 3 weeks. This from the BBC.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has requested $75 million from Congress in order to fund internal opposition to the rule of religious leaders in Iran. This funding will support TV and radio broadcasting into Iran, student exchanges, as well as labor unions and human rights groups. Anastasia Nistiskaya reports from Washington, D.C.
In today's hearing on international affairs budget proposal, Condoleezza Rice laid out the State Department's plan concerning Iran.
We will be asking in a supplemental request for an additional $75 million for democracy programs in Iran. Perhaps one of the biggest challenges that we face is the policy of the Iranian regime of destabilization of the world's most volatile and vulnerable region.
Senator Sam Brownback, a Republican from Kansas, praised the initiative as the absolutely right move at this point in time. Martin Indyk, a former Clinton administration official and an expert on the Middle East, said that U.S. aid to democratic forces within Iran will cause mistrust within their bases of support and could therefore be counterproductive. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnizditska in Washington, D.C.
And this has been the KBOO Morning News for Friday, February 17th, 2006. Chris Andre edited the news, KBOO's volunteer audio editors edited the tape, and KBOO's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director and is also on the board. I'm Jim Thompson.
And I'm Chris Andre.
We welcome your participation in the AM Newsroom. To volunteer, call us at 503-231-8032, extension 202. Reach us by email at amnews@kboo.org or drop by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. The KBOO website is www.kboo.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM Portland, 107 FM Corvallis on translator K264AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on translator K220HR. Be sure to join us at 5 p.m. for a solid hour of solid news on the KBOO Evening News. Portland area weather, mostly cloudy with a chance of snow. Windy, especially in the Eastern Gorge, highs in the 30s. Tonight, mostly cloudy, chance of snow. Temperatures in the 20s. There is a freeze warning for some coastal areas and the Cascades. And coming up on KBOO. At 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, Marlena Smith hosts her Electronic Salon. She'll speak with Ed Goldberg about politics and culture, and she'll present a program from Dave Emery on the reissuing of classic political books on the Internet. And 11, it's Democracy Now!
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for February 17th. If you like jazz, you're in luck. The Portland Jazz Festival starts today. The Jazz Festival runs February 17th through the 26th at various locations and times throughout PDX. There will be various artists, education events, and discussions. For more info, visit www.pdxjazz.com. Vancouver Critical Mass is having another celebratory bicycle ride through Vancouver, Washington, today at 5:30 p.m. at Esther Short Park. Everyone is welcome. If you have a bicycle, come ride. The Southridge High School presents The West Side Story. The West Side Story is a love story between Tony and Maria, amidst the backdrops of racial tension between their two worlds in the Upper West Side of New York City in 1958. This play will be showing at the Southridge Auditorium at 9625 Southwest 125th Avenue in Beaverton, Oregon. For more info, please call 503-259-5486 or visit them on the web at www.southridgetheater.org. Mike Houck, director of the Urban Green Spaces Institute, will speak tonight at 7 through 9 p.m. at PSU in the School of Business of Administration in room 190. His presentation will be In Livable Cities is Preservation of the Wild. This is free for all. And for more info, email hmcky@pdx.edu. That was Community Calendar for Friday, February 17th. I'm Latoya Hudson, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, Corvallis, and Hood River.
And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon Children's Theater presenting the world premiere of The Giver, the story of a boy learning of the tragic sacrifices his community has made for safety and security. The Giver runs March 5th, 11th, and 12th, 2 p.m., at Keller Auditorium, 222 Southwest Clay. Tickets at 503-228-9571 or Ticketmaster.com. Appropriate for ages 10 and up. Information about The Giver at octc.org. Stay tuned for Positively Revolting.